Okay, it's a pleasure to be here at IATP, and I would like to thank for the invitation to give the ASTRO seminar here today. So I'm going to talk about Taiwanese supernova explosions and how we are trying to model those events at the Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics in Garching. There are a number of people involved in these efforts. They are listed here and all contribute to the work I'm going to present. Now, numerical models of type 1a supernovae are challenged by various observational results, and one of the main motivations to trying to better understand type 1a supernovae, of course, comes from cosmology. This is often emphasized, especially if you apply for observation time or funding. But anyway, the new cosmological standard picture was initiated in great part by type 1a supernova measurements. Yet an unknown homework to the type 1a supernova community is to explain the correlation between the peak luminosity of type 1a supernovae and the light curve shape that is used to calibrate those distance measurements and facilitated the use of type 1a supernovae as cosmological standard candles. Now, one of the next steps that's going to be taken by type 1a supernova cosmology is to address the question whether we can constrain the dark energy equation of state with type 1a supernova observations, and I think the answer is pretty clear. It's no, unless we can control the systematical errors here. The statistical errors will be no problem given the huge number of observations that is expected within the next years, but the systematics will be the big obstacle, and the only way to get a handle on the systematics is to better understand the physical mechanism of type 1a supernova explosions. And one approach to this is to try to model type 1As from first principles. So we try to construct models that are as parameter-free as possible. In the 1980s, it was popular to run one-dimensional type 1a supernova models because this is what was possible back then. But these one-dimensional models contain a lot of tunable parameters, so their predictive power is too low to tackle questions of cosmology. So we are trying to model type 1a supernova explosions in three dimensions, and of course this has to be done in close connection to observation of nearby objects. And from this, the second challenge to type 1a supernova models arises, that is, over the last years, type 1a supernova observations of nearby objects and models have reached equality, where it's now really possible to constrain the models on the basis of comparison with observation and even to discriminate between different mechanisms. The MPA has been involved in those observational campaigns via a European research training network, and of particular interest for comparison models with observations is the spectroscopic data obtained here. I will give three examples for this. The first example is late-time spectra, the nebula spectra. About 300 days after the explosion, the explosion ejecta become diluted so much due to the expansion that they become transparent. And at this spectra taken at this epoch look right into the center of the supernova explosion, and of course contain a lot of information about the explosion mechanism. The second example is spectrophotometry. The group around Lifang Wang at Berkeley could show that at least some type 1a supernovae are significantly polarized, though not as much as core collapse supernovae, but still this spectrophotometry data contains information about the multidimensional structure of the explosion process, and since we are trying to model type 1as in three dimensions, a comparison with such data would be desirable. The third example is shown here for supernova 2002 BO. That was actually the first supernova observed within the European Research Training Network, and the outcome is shown here on the left-hand side. We have a very good coverage with high-quality spectra on an almost daily basis. Now, with such data, one can now go ahead and try to fit those observed spectra with synthetic spectra. From this, one can derive the composition of the ejecta at the current position of the photosphere. Now, doing this for the whole sequence of data, one of course obtains the composition of the ejector slice by slice because the photosphere moves inwards. And this method was developed by Matthias Steele in Paolo Mazzani at MPA, and they call it abundance tomography. The outcome is shown here on the right-hand side. I have to apologize, this plot is rather confusing, but I want to point out some of the main features if one tries to compare models to the observations. That is, we find iron group elements here shown in green and in black, mixed out to rather large radii. Also, intermediate mass elements, silicon is shown here in red, are distributed over a wide range in velocity space. Now, these are the two main products of Fermi supernova explosions, and their distribution agrees quite well with current Taiwanese supernova models. However, a problem to current models could be that here we don't see any unburnt material. Oxygen is shown here in blue at low velocities. So I will come back to this issue later. Now, if we try to meet all those challenges from observations and explain these features with numerical simulations, we first have to construct the basic underlying astrophysical scenario. And this, of course, has to be derived from the main features of Taiwanese supernova. I just want to briefly remind you of some of those. That is, we find no hydrogen in the spectra. We observe a huge energy release of about 10 to the 51 ergs. So assuming the Taiwanese supernova originate from a single stellar object, it is clear that possible energy sources are only the gravitational binding energy or nuclear energy. Since we don't find any compact remnant in Taiwanese supernovae, and since these objects occur in old as well as in young populations, it is clear that it was suggested that actually Taiwanese supernovae are thermonuclear explosions of white dwarf stars.
Fritz, yes. Out of curiosity, when would the result of simulating polarization of Taiwan-A first come out?
When did it first come out?
Yes.
The first?
Yeah. Is it a recent thing or
not? I think for Taiwanese it is around 2000, something like this. So curious right there. Yeah. I think it was supernova 2000 ER or something. Well, yeah, I have to look into this, I don't remember. So another important property of Taiwanese supernovae is, of course, that their characteristics are very uniform, which facilitated their use as cosmological standard canons. And of course, this feature has also to go into the modeling, as we will see soon. Now, the first question one has to answer is how an inert object like a white dwarf can reach a state where it can trigger a thermonuclear explosion. And so in order to introduce dynamics into the system, several scenarios have been proposed. One is the so-called double degenerate scenario, where two white dwarfs in a binary system merge, so that the smaller white dwarf is disrupted and its material is created on the more massive companion, so that it reaches densities where a thermonuclear explosion can ignite. In principle, this is a very nice picture, because if one assumes that these two white dwarfs are carbon-oxygen white dwarfs, this provides a natural way of explaining why we don't see any hydrogen in the spectra. However, another interesting feature is that in principle, it can also explain the observed Taiwanese supernova rate, because double degenerate systems are pretty common. However, recently, the ESO SPY survey looked into 3,000 such objects, and they identified only one or two possible candidates to evolve into a Taiwanese supernova, and this seems pretty low. Another problem for this double degenerate model is that the accretion rate onto the more massive white dwarf is pretty high, so that one could expect carbon shower flashes, which would drive the burning front into the white dwarf, converting the carbon-oxygen material to oxygen, neon, magnesium. Now, oxygen, neon, magnesium white dwarfs are known to tend to undergo a gravitational collapse rather than a thermonuclear explosion. The alternative scenario is the so-called single degenerate scenario, where we have a carbon-oxygen white dwarf that accretes matter from a non-degenerate binary companion, which could be either a main sequence star or an AGB star. This scenario subdivides into different classes, and one is the so-called subgeneral Zeta mass models, in which the white dwarf accretes matter with rather high accretion rates, so that a layer of helium piles up on top of the carbon oxygen core, so that one expects a detonation in this helium shell, and this detonation wave then converges into the center of the white dwarf, where it triggers the explosion. However, a sufficient collimation of this detonation rate to trigger the explosion is difficult to achieve in multiple dimensions, because slight breaking of the symmetry could already prevent a sufficient collimation. And also, the nuclear synthesis of such the subchannel Zeka mass models could be inconsistent with the main channel of Taiwanese supernovae, but this is, of course, model dependent.
So the comment on nuclear synthesis, is that from the 1D models, or is that also from the multidimensional models?
I think that comes from the 1D models, but I think people have stopped to look closely into these models. So I think this is probably not very robust, so that could be inconsistent, but I mean, for this, this is model dependent. So, yeah. So the two scenarios presented so far can, in principle, contribute to the Taiwanese supernova sample. However, the main contribution is expected to come from the currently favored scenario, and this is this Chandrasekhar mass model. Here, the black dwarf accretes with rates that are low enough so that the accreted material can be converted in the quiet hydrostatic burning into carbon, so that the carbon-oxygen white dwarf increases its mass until it comes close to the Chandrasekhar mass. At this point, it reaches densities in the center where carbon burning ignites, and this triggers the type 1A supernova explosion. Now, this model is particularly interesting because it explains why type 1A supernovae are so uniform, confining the available fuel in the thermonuclear explosion to roughly the Chandrasekhar mass. Possible candidates for such progenitor systems are the supersoft X-ray sources. For instance, Euscorpii could evolve into a type 1A supernova in 20,000 years or so. However, there's also a problem with such models, and this is that theoretically the rate expected from such scenario could be too low because of the very narrow window and scale space for the correct accretion rates to build up a Chandrasekhar mass white dwarf.
This is competing with the
former. Well, I mean, right now, well, that's the conclusion of all this.
You would be losing a fair number of systems to that first case that was producing something other than that.
Right. Mm-hmm. And also, if we have even lower accretion rates, you would expect nova outbursts, and this could also prevent carbon supernovae from occurring. So it's really a hard problem to accrete the matter in the right way that you build up a Chandrasekhar mass like growth. So the conclusion from all this is that the progenitor system of type 1A supernovae is still an open issue, in contrast to type 2 supernovae, where the progenitor is simply a massive star. Now, looking into the details of the ignition, things don't become much easier, unfortunately. The principle is clear, it's outlined here in this sketch. Here I sketch the carbon ignition curve. This is log temperature over log density, and above this red curve, carbon burning ignites. Now, the trajectory of the white dwarf that accretes matter would be something like this. We start off with a rather cool white dwarf, which accretes matter, and therefore its central density increases until it crosses the carbon ignition line. And after this, a phase of convective carbon burning is expected, which I hope to learn more about while I'm here in Santa Barbara. Now, this phase of convective carbon burning will last for about 1,000 years until the energy, nuclear energy generation is not balanced anymore by convective cooling. At this point, a very thin and very narrow spatial region will undergo a thermonuclear runaway, and so we get a very thin layer in which we have explosive carbon burning, and this is the formation of a flame. So the approach to the thermonuclear runaway was recently simulated by Luigi Apicino at MPA, yet there are several uncertainties with this. So this is mainly the exact location where the flame formation takes place. So there are different scenarios. The multi-spot ignition scenario, Whitley et al., assumes that the flame ignites in a multitude of sparks around the center of the white dwarf, or maybe only on one side of the center of the white dwarf, depending on the large-scale convective flow pattern. But there are other groups who claim that the flame should ignite in only one single spot in the center. Now, luckily, we are trying to model the explosion stage itself, and here the physics is much better known. From hydrodynamics, we know that the flame propagates, the flame can propagate outward in two different modes. One is the so-called deflagration mode, in which the flame propagates with subsonic velocities due to the mediation by microphysical transfer processes, in this case, thermal conduction of the electrons. The other mode is a detonation, in which the flame propagates with supersonic velocities driven by shock waves. Now, already in the late 1960s, by the first supernova simulations by Dave Arnett, it became clear that a pure prompt detonation wouldn't work to explain M1A supernovae. And this is because here the flame propagates with supersonic velocities, therefore it incinerates the whole white dwarf at rather high densities, producing mainly iron group elements. However, spectra of type 1a supernovae show significant features that come from intermediate mass elements, and the only way to produce those is if the star has time to pre-expand prior to incineration. And this is provided if the flame actually starts out as a slow deflagration, as proposed by Nomura et al. The problem with this is that a pure laminar deflagration flame is much too slow. It cannot burn enough material so that the energy release wouldn't be sufficient to explode the star. And here the most important aspect of the model comes into play, and this is the interaction of the flame with turbulence, making type 1a supernovae a problem of turbulent combustion. Typical Reynolds numbers for the scenario are as high as 10 to the 14, and therefore it is clear that instabilities will inevitably generate strong turbulence. Instabilities, however, are inherent in the picture, and this is because the flame propagates from the center outwards, and we have behind the flame light and hard ashes, and in front of the flame we have dense and cold fuel. So this is an inverse density stratification in the gravitational field of the star, and therefore it is subject to buoyancy instabilities. Now, these buoyancy instabilities, the famous Fourier-Tiller instability, leads in its nonlinear regime to the formation of hot burning bubbles that raise into the cold fuel. These bubbles have a typical mushroom-like shape, as we will also see in the simulations, and on the edges of these rising bubbles, we observe strong shear flows. Now, these shear flows give rise to secondary instabilities. The Clavien-Helmholtz instability generates turbulent eddies, and these turbulent eddies then decay to smaller and smaller scales, forming the turbulent eddy cascade until the turbulent energy is dissipated away at the Kolmogorov scale, which is for type 1a supernova only of the order of 1 millimeter. Now, in the right sub-range of this scale space that is occupied by the turbulent cascade, the flame actually interacts with turbulent eddies, and the result is that the flame is wrinkled and stretched, and this enlarges the flame surface area, and therefore the net burning rate is enhanced, and this strongly accelerates the flame propagation. Now, in this way, it is possible that the flame can burn enough material to release enough energy so that the white dwarf explodes. However, there's some debate among type 1a supernova modelers whether or not one needs a later transition of the flame propagation mode from deflagration to a detonation. So some groups claim that this is necessary to explain all observational features. The problem with this is that right now nobody knows how this transition from a deflagration to a detonation should work in type 1a supernova. No physical mechanism is known to provide this here, and so including a delayed detonation would mean to include a further unknown parameter into the models which we want to avoid, and we are also motivated by the fact that already the pure deflagration models seem to become very close to the observations. Now, to round off the picture of type 1a supernovae, I will just briefly mention the remnant. As said before, we don't find any compact object as a remnant, but the remnant is rather a diffuse cloud of ejecta. The most famous example is the remnant of Tycho Brahe's supernova of 1572, here shown in the X-rays taken by the Chandra satellite. Now this is a particularly interesting object because recently a group of astronomers around Pilar Ruiz Labrente looked into the center of this remnant, and they identified a star there that moves with significantly higher velocities than all the other stars, and this star was suggested to be the binary companion of the progenitor system. If this is true, this is very interesting because this star is actually a main sequence star very similar to our Sun, which would corroborate the single degenerate scenario. Now coming back to the explosion mechanism, if we try to simulate numerically the explosion, we first have to develop numerical techniques for this, and this was mainly done by Martin Reinecke in his PhD work at MPA. Although the hydrodynamics is based on a much older implementation of the piecewise parabolic method by Colella and Woodward, so it's a finite volume Godunov-like approach. Of course, we have to model turbulence in our simulations, and since the frame interacts with turbulent motions on a wide range of scales, we have to model turbulence on scales that are not resolved in our models, and this is achieved with a subgrid scale model, which makes our simulations very similar to what is known as large eddy simulations from computational fluid dynamics. Another problem is to model the plane, because here we also encounter a scale problem. If we try to model the supernova explosions on scale on the of the white dwarf, which is about 10 to the 8 centimeters, it is not possible to resolve the internal frame structure in the foreseeable future, which is only about 1 millimeter. So therefore, it's justified to regard the flame as a sharp discontinuity separating fuel from the ashes, and this is handled in our implementation by the so-called Leverstadt method, which is a numerical technique to track the evolution of interfaces. Now this is outlined sketched here in this two-dimensional example. The interface we want to track is the flame front, and this is associated with the zero level set of the signed distance function g. Now if we evolve the g-field in an appropriate way, we can model the propagation of the flame front. And this is particularly nice because it can handle topological changes without difficulties. Of course, if we model the flame as a sharp discontinuity and do not resolve its internal structure, we have to somehow prescribe the flame propagation velocity to the model. And here, knowledge from engineering comes in handy, and this is the notion that turbulent combustion actually proceeds in different regimes. And it turns out that for type 1a supernovae, the so-called flamelit regime of turbulent combustion applies, which is, by the way, the same you have in your car engine. So in this flamelit regime, it is known that the flame propagation velocity completely decouples from the microphysics of the burning, and it is entirely determined by the turbulent velocity fluctuations, which we know from our subgrid scale model, so it comes out of our model and it's not an external parameter which we could tune.
How sensitive is this to the state of the oxygen core at the time when the deflagration begins? In other words, it could have been sitting around so long that it's solidified versus in fluid. Do those issues impact some of these turbulence? Or?
I mean, what really alters the evolution of the turbulence is, of course, the density profile you have in the just there. In our model, the temperature is not an important parameter because that would, of course, alter the reaction rates and therefore the flame propagation, but only the laminar flame propagation, not the turbulent flame propagation, because this is again caused by the turbulence. Now another thing we have to model, of course, is the nuclear burning. To do this correctly, one would have to apply a huge reaction network, and this is much too expensive to run concurrently with our hydrodynamic simulations, and therefore we include a simplified description of nuclear burning, only including carbon, five species, carbon and oxygen as unburned material. Magnesium represents intermediate mass elements, and nuclear statistical equilibrium compositions are represented by alpha particles and nickel. So at high fuel densities, we burn all material that is crossed by the flame front to directly to NSE. And if the fuel density drops below 5 times 10 to the 7 grams per cubic centimeter, we burn to intermediate mass elements. And in each case, the appropriate amount of energy is released, and this is enough to handle the explosion dynamics. However, if one wants to derive synthetic light crystal spectra from the model, one has to do better than this. And to this end, we apply a nucleosynthesis post-processing, which was implemented for type 1a supernovae by Claudio Tavaglio and Marius Givera at MPA. The idea here is to eject a number of tracer particles with our explosion simulations. So this adds a Lagrangian component to an Eulerian code. And these tracer particles now record the evolution of density and temperature. And with this information, it is possible to reconstruct the nuclear reactions with a large reaction network provided by Friedrich Tiedemann in Basel. Now, putting all this together, one can go ahead and perform simulations. In a very simple example as shown in this movie here, unfortunately, it will not be possible to see the star itself. This movie here shows only the flame front, which is this represented by this isosurface here. So as you can see, this is a very simple setup. We simulate only one spatial octant, we assume mirror symmetry to the other octants, and we ignite the flame in the center, perturbed by those toroidal rings. Now, if we start the simulation, it is obvious that the buoyancy instability quickly leads to the generation of such mushroom-like features. These are then superposed by smaller and smaller generations of instability patterns. Turbulence is generated, and the flame is accelerated, and this is enough to explode the star.
So when they're in zone, it doesn't just depend on the composition, it's also how well mixed it is.
Very cool.
Within a zone, you need to not only know what the composition is, but also how well mixed it is.
Well, in our zone, I mean, we have, of course, the values of the level set, which tells us where the flame is. Uh-huh. And behind the flame, we have ashes, and in front of the flame, we have the fuel. And so we convert everything that's crossed by this flame front to ashes, uh-huh, according to the fuel density, to intermediate mass elements, or to NSE compositions. And then we adjust the NSE composition, alpha particles, and nickel, according to the state in the ashes.
But it doesn't depend what you get from these formulas variables. I guess you're carrying other variables.
Well, the turbulence models just tells us how fast the interface here moves. So that sets the flame propagation velocity.
What's perturbing the symmetry? Is it just numerical jitter in the algorithms, or
well, of course,
is that throwing some extra perturbation?
And then this, let me go back here. So of course, we have set in here some perturbation of the symmetry, of course, by those toroidal rings. And then, of course, we have discretization errors that perturb the symmetry in this heat wave. Yeah. But of course, I mean, other models simply assume a perfect sphere in the center and just wait until numerical noise perturbs the symmetry. But of course, that's a waste of computer time because it will happen anyway. So you can just test how noisy your code is. So. Otherwise, it does not tell you anything about the supernova explosion.
What did you say was introducing the variations in the phi direction? I guess you've introduced the theta direction.
Well, that's a Cartesian computational grid, and therefore you have discretization errors which are different in the phi direction.
That's completely responsible for the perturbations that you see in the final.
Raises the question of how sensitive you are to the your
to the initial
phi, how discrete your grid is. Are you increasing the surface area just by changing your grid resolution and getting different propagation speeds on your tube?
No. Of course, we have some perturbations in this. And in the end, we will always end up to develop large-scale structures like these mushrooms that dominate the polar energy. That's because if you have this thing, it's called Schaubiller cascade. If you have buoyant bubbles, they will emerge and form larger structures.
Is there an easy way to understand what's the maximum scale for those turbulent structures?
Well, I mean, that's of course a question whether that's of course a question whether this is constrained by the symmetries which we imprint on this by simulating only one octant. But I will come back to this question later. So we have performed also. But I mean, in the end, the structures you see here that are resolved, that is only something that, well, that's only the resolved model, of course. But if you were to resolve finer trivialized structures, which you, of course, have there, I mean, you go to smaller and smaller scales, and you will always see structure there because
sure,
it's similar. But this is compensated by the subgrid scale model. So if you resolve less structure, then it will tell you that the flame front should propagate faster. So that you end up, well, the product of area, you have surface area, turbulent surface area, and propagation velocity should be should stay the same. And this is what makes your numerical simulations converge in the end. And actually, our simulations are converged with respect to global quantities like energy production. Okay, so what's the status of such models? Four models similar to the one shown before, the first synthetic light curves have been derived by our colleagues in Moscow. The result is shown here and compared to observations shown in green, and these compare rather well. The best model so far was computed also by Martin Reinecke at MPA. It's the so-called B30 model. It had a slightly different setup than the one shown before. So in this case, the flame was ignited in a multitude of spots, in 30 different spots, and this is a representation of the multi-spot ignition scenario. In this model, we obtained about 0.7 core of energy, which is already pretty close to what one expects from the observations. Another important parameter of the models is how much nickel 56 they actually produce, because it is the radioactive decay of nickel 56 that powers the light curve. As you can see here, the mass of the of nickel 56 produced in the model directly translates to the brightness of the light curve. These are two models with different nickel production, so the blue model produced more nickel 56. Now, for the B30 model, we produced about 0.4 solar masses of nickel, which is also within the range of what you would expect from the observations, but it's rather on the low side, so we are trying to improve our models and to produce more nickel 56. Now,
so I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Is it? It's called BESS because it produced the most nickel, or why?
Well, it produced the most nickel and the most energy in the end. But of course, I mean, if you start out from more realistic initial scenarios, I mean, this model I showed in the movie with the toroidal perturbation is of course not a very realistic initial flame front. So if you just ignite a large part of the star in this kind of way, it's much better if you start out with very small bubbles that ignite. But this is of course just a speculation because nobody knows how it should be known.
Are your nickel and energy numbers coming from your post-processing with
trace elements? The nickel 56 comes from the post-processing, yes. Uh-huh. Because we track only the iron group elements as a whole. So. And of course, if you want to know how much is nickel 56, you have to do the post-processing.
And then would impact the energy numbers you're getting too.
So the total energy
would be getting.
The total energy comes out of the model, of the explosion model.
So you're not getting that much different reason?
No, from the post-processing and from the numbers, that's a few percent difference, but not significant. So with models like the one shown in the movie, it is already possible to perform parameter studies, and we performed the first study of initial parameters of three-dimensional models. Now, the idea here is that one tries to explain the observed diversity of type 1a supernovae as a first step to explaining correlations between different features, which one then uses to correct for the diversity, and several initial parameters have been proposed to account for this diversity, and out of the number of possible parameters, we picked only three, and this is the progenitor's carbon-to-oxygen ratio, and its central density at ignition, both were varied in the exposure hydrodynamics code. Another parameter is the progenitor's metallicity, This was recently studied in an analytical way by Timmis et al. And here, the idea is that the progenitor's metallicity should finally end up in a certain EN22 mass fraction of the exploding white dwarf star. And this EN22 mass fraction we varied in the post-processing. Now, all those parameters were changed independently to see what effect each individual parameter would have on the models, although in reality, they are, of course, interrelated by stellar evolution, so the central density, the carbon to oxygen ratio will possibly depend on the metallicity, which is not taken into account here. To be able to simulate a whole grid of such models, we had to, again, to apply a very simplified one-octane centrally ignited model, which we know explodes very weakly. As you can see from this plot here, this is total energy in the models over time. This is zero, where the star becomes unbound. And all models explode rather quickly, but still we see trends from the initial parameters. And this is, if we go to lower central densities, the energy generation is delayed, and we end up with less total energy in our model. Also changing the progenitor's carbon to oxygen ratio has a significant impact on the energy production of the models. After nucleosynthesis post-processing, we obtain the nickel-56 mass that is produced in our models, and this is, of course, important because, according to our next rule, it directly translates to the brightness of the supernova. Now, one parameter we looked into was the progenitor's carbon to oxygen ratio, and here we expected a rather large impact on the nickel-56 production, because if one burns carbon to NSE, then releases more energy than burning oxygen to NSE because of the differences in the binding energy. So carbon-rich models would are expected to explode much more vigorously, and therefore we expected that the flame here would burn more material at high densities and therefore produce more nickel-56. However, this is not what we see in our models. As you can see from this plot here, the nickel-56 mass depends only very weakly on the carbon mass fraction. And this rather surprising result is also corroborated by the flame evolution in the models. Here I've plotted the flame front for three different models with different carbon to oxygen ratios on top of each other in a transparent layout. This is visible. So the flame front is very similar in all three models. And the reason for this is that in our models, models with different carbon to oxygen ratios produce different compositions of the NSE in the ashes. So carbon-rich models produce more alpha particles, and these alpha particles now act as an energy buffer because they lower the average binding energy of the burning products. Therefore, approximately the same amount of energy goes into the dynamics, and this is actually what causes the flame burns the same amount of material, producing roughly the same amount of nickel-56. Now, of course, later when the temperature and the density drops, these alpha particles recombine and release the stored energy, but this happens at stages where burning mostly terminates already in intermediate mass elements, so the production of nickel-56 is not affected anymore. The second parameter...
Sorry, is it weak interactions in electron
capture? Not yet, no.
Okay. So the only way you get a neutron is here is from the EON-22?
Yes. Okay. This is also a problem
here.
Yeah, well, that's also a problem here. So the next parameter we looked into was the central density. Here we see a significant impact going from low central densities to intermediate central densities. And this is, again, consistent with the flame evolution. Here we see differences. The orange model is a model with low central density, and the blue model with intermediate central density. Now, the reason for this is that in models with different central densities, the flame experiences different gravitational acceleration. So this is a model with low central density. The gravitational acceleration at the flame location is much lower. Therefore, the development of instability features is delayed and less pronounced. We produce less turbulent energy, and therefore the flame burns slower, and it burns less material at high densities, and therefore you produce less iron group elements and also less nickel-56. But there is a competing effect to this. which Lotz already mentioned, and this is electron captures, which are expected to become important by even higher central densities. Now, these electron capture electron captures now favor the production of neutron-rich nuclei instead of nickel 56, for instance, nickel 58. But nickel 58 doesn't contribute to the luminosity of Taiwanese supernovae. So therefore, the nickel 56 drops again with higher central densities. This is not currently not implemented consistently in our code, but we are trying to implement this. Now, third parameter we looked into was metallicity, and here we see the significant impact of the metallicity on the nickel 56 production. And our data is consistent with the linear relation that was analytically predicted by Timmis et al. Going from to higher metallicities, the nickel 56 mass drops, and this is because the metallicities represented by neon-20p, neon-22 has a neutron excess, and therefore it again favors the production of neutron-rich nuclei instead of nickel 56. Now, this table here summarizes the result of our parameter study. As you've seen, the carbon to oxygen ratio has only very little impact on the nickel 56 production, so therefore it does not affect the peak luminosity of Taiwanese very much. However, it has some impact on the total energy we get, and therefore possibly on a light curve shape. The central density affects both peak luminosity and light curve shape, while the metallicity has only an impact on the nickel 56 production. Now we can say that the parameters under consideration here can partially account for the observed diversity within branch normal Taiwanese supernovae, but it certainly cannot cover the whole diversity that is observed. Also, we could not identify a single parameter that would reproduce the empirically established peak luminosity light curve shape relation. Maybe that could be possible with a combination of parameters that is reasonable from stellar evolution. For this, of course, to test those better initial models are needed, and I hope to get input here from the group in Santa Barbara. Now, of course, to judge all those effects, finally one has to compare synthetic light curves derived from our models, and this is currently being done by our collaborators in Moscow. Now, a second task we addressed recently was to make our models better comparable to observations via synthetic spectra mainly, and for this, of course, one has to evolve the models to a molecule expansion. So far, all multidimensional models, also these for other groups, terminated below 2 seconds. Now, from one-dimensional models, it is expected that one reaches homologous expansion only after something like 7 or 8 seconds. So our goal was to evolve the models to roughly 10 seconds. This was not possible with our previous implementation because, as mentioned before, we performed the simulation on a Cartesian static grid, which is indicated by the blue or black lines here. Although this grid is non-uniform, it has larger cells in the outer parts to capture at least some parts of the expansion in the explosion process. But to be able to follow the expansion for much longer times, we implemented a co-moving grid that tracks the expansion of the white dwarf. This is indicated by the green lines here, and the edge of the white dwarf is shown in red. And from this simple two-dimensional simulations, you see that this works rather well. The flame contours, again shown here in green and blue, are very similar for both implementations. Now, with such two-dimensional simulations, it's possible to test whether we really approach homologous expansion after 10 seconds to sufficient accuracy, and this is actually the case. So the criteria for homologous expansion are sub-similar expansion, vanishing pressure, and gravitational potential gradients, and all energy should be converted to kinetic energy, and this is all the case in our models. Now, we can go ahead and...
So then you must get the density law. Density is a function of velocity. Mm-hmm. The power law of the density profile matters later on for the light curve.
Mm-hmm.
route the photosphere moves back in velocity space.
Yeah.
So you actually, you're usually just described as a power law, right?
Uh-huh. But I didn't look into details of the chemical structure.
But I think that was always an issue of what, of how the density changes with velocity in the law of this expansion phase.
Yeah.
Because that then tells you how the photosphere moves well, the velocity space.
Sure, but this, yeah, but the rate of force depends on your explosion process, right?
Well, I, that's what I'm saying. I mean, yeah. If I'm understanding what you're saying, this might be the first case where you actually have a calculation that gives you
that gives an answer, yeah.
As mm-hmm. opposed to,
sure.
mm-hmm. You know, a guess.
Yeah. Okay, so this cool moving grid was then applied also to three-dimensional simulations, and an example is shown here. So again, our simple one-octane centrally ignited model. But as you can see, the distribution of the ashes still changes from 2 seconds to 10 seconds, so it's really necessary to evolve the models to 10 seconds. And with this cool moving grid approach, the computational costs for doing this are very moderate because the CFL time step grows. Now, from this model, actually, the first synthetic spectrum at, in the nebular phase was derived by our colleagues in Sweden. Unfortunately, they picked this particular model because this is a very artificial initial condition, and we know that it explodes very weakly, so it was never intended to compare this model to observations. But it was just a test for implementation. So nevertheless, some features of the synthetic spectrum shown here in red compare rather well to the observations shown here in black. And this is mainly the broad iron lines. And these broad iron lines are a result of the distribution of burnt material in velocity space due to the rising bubbles. The ionization levels of the iron lines are not accurately reproduced, but this is possibly because of the density structure of this weakly exploding model. However, we see, so this could be better in more elaborate models. However, we see a severe problem here that there could be a generic problem to all deflagration models, and this is that we see in the synthetic spectrum strong indication for unburned material at low velocities. This is this oxygen line here and carbon line here, which is not present in the observations. This is a result of downdraft in between those rising bubbles, which transport unburned material towards the center, and it's not clear at the moment whether it's possible to burn this material that is transported in the downdrafts so that you end up with less unburned material at low velocities. So we are currently investigating this in more elaborate models. Yeah.
So these are normal supernovae you're comparing with in this case?
Yes. Uh-huh.
So how does this compare with maybe a weaker supernova that might be similar to this technical?
I mean, that's hard to tell because we have only nebular spectra of only kind of a handful of objects. So that's not easy to get those. So I think, these are at least two supernovae spectra at the nebula phase which we could get. So we had also another model in 2000 CX, I think, which is a weirdo, and this looked a little bit different. So this had, so that's mainly the ionization structure you get in the iron lines. And whether or not you see a carbon line here in the observation is also not quite clear because the spectrum more or less ends here, so that's also hard to tell. But it doesn't seem that you could have low velocity under material in the model, so we can kind of just work on this.
Where does detonation go?
Well, detonation.
basically, we're out here at 10 seconds, and we're comparing now to final spectra.
Well, if you ignited delay detonation, and of course, you could think that this would burn down these downdraft channels
right.
And burn all the material. But the question is, first of all, where the detonation should ignite. That's not clear. So, we know the mechanism that could provide such a transition. But one speculation is that it happens where the flame actually does not where the flame regime does not apply anymore to the flame propagation, but where the flame enters the distributed flaming regime, that is, the turbulence enters the internal flame structure and changes something in the flame so that it could trigger detonation. So this is expected to happen roughly at 10 to the 7 grams per cubic centimeter, which is interestingly exactly the density which you put into one-dimensional models and get the best fit. So, but no one knows how this is going to happen. So if you would ignite a detonation here, then the point where it the flame reaches 10 to the 7 grams per cubic centimeters would be somewhere here at the top of such rising bubbles, right? And so the detonation rate would have to go around and go down the channel. The question is whether a detonation rate can really go through ashes, and this was recently studied by Jens Niemeyer and his group in Würzburg, and they found that already very thin layers of ashes of the order of millimeters or centimeters can prevent the detonation wave to reignite on the other side. So that is really a great obstacle, and since you would expect the part of the unburned material to end up in pockets, it's not clear whether you can really burn this material. So possibly not, but of course the models that are currently around, that's the Kochlov model, they just ignited the flame in the center and let the detonation go through everything and reignite on the other side because the resolution was very crude. And you see that the stall of the detonation wave is only seen if you have very high resolution for this. And this was studied with one-dimensional models with EMR in the flash code. So it's not quite clear whether this would really help. And yeah. So as a last point, I want to mention a study that addressed the development of asphericities in such deflagration models. So of course, to assess asphericities and asymmetries, one has first to abolish the artificial symmetry constraint to our octane symmetry. And for this, we implemented a full star simulation. And as a first case, ignited the flame again with our central ignition, now mirrored to the other octants. And this was done as a test to see whether we would miss any important large-scale features of the flame if we simulate only one spatial octant. And this seems to be not the case. This picture here compares a full star simulation shown in blue with a one octant simulation shown in yellow. This is again mirrored to the other octants. And the flame propagation is very similar, so we don't see the development of any large-scale features here, which is different in type 2 simulations, where it was recently discovered that you would get large dipolar modes, which we don't find in type 1a supernovae or flame structures. So that, of course, corroborates our octant models, that if we really want to study asymmetries, we have to start out with an asymmetric initial flame, of course. And this is done with this kind of flame flame configuration. This foamy kind of flame was composed of a number of bubbles. This mimics the multi-stop ignition scenario that is motivated by pre-ignition convection. Now, due to the random placement of those small bubbles, the flame as a whole is slightly displaced from the center of the white rope for about 13 kilometers, which is a little bit more of displacement than in the model of the Chicago group you may have heard of. Now, in the Chicago model, however, they were unlucky with the choice of the initial flame shape because they assumed the flame to be a perfect symmetric sphere. And due to this symmetry of the initial flame, a very symmetric flow established, which would then drive out the flame from the center towards the surface of the star, so that only a very small amount of matter could be burned, and this did not lead to the explosion of the star. Now, this is different in our model because of the more structured initial flame motivated by pre-ignition convection. Quickly, those buoyancy instabilities develop the mushroom-like shapes. You see here, turbulence is generated, the flame accelerates. The color-coded in this movie is a measure of the local flame propagation velocity. The flame stays roughly centered in the star and burns a significant part of the star so that the energy release is large enough to lead to a viable explosion. Now this flame surface looks a little bit asymmetric, but if one really wants to judge the asymmetries in such a model, one has to look into the distribution of the different species we follow. And this is shown in this movie here. So the most important species is of course the iron group elements, and nickel 56 contained within those. So this movie here shows the column, the evolution of the column density of iron group elements over the XY coordinate plane. And as you can see, the evolution is very asymmetric. We have more iron group elements on the right hand side, and we also see the, well, that's hard to see here on the screen, the typical mushroom-like features. So both features could contribute to the polarization of the spectra. However, this of course has to be tested in multi-dimensional radiation transport codes derived from those models, which is currently not available. Unfortunately, but that's one of our next goals, to look into this in more detail. So I will conclude with this. The deflagration models have been shown to explain many of the observational features, but not all. There are some problems with the pure deflagration model that needs improvement. So we are currently preparing a large-scale simulation to resolve more of the turbulent structures. So again, our models are already converged in numerically converged in global quantities like energy, but the distribution due to the turbulent features could be still different. Now also we tried to cure the low velocity under material problem. Several approaches to this are possible. One can improve the subgrid scale model, which was currently accomplished by Wolfram Schmidt in Würzburg. Another way to cure the low velocity problem possibly is to test different initial flame configurations. If you start with multi-spot ignition scenarios, you can try to put more and more ignition spots with higher resolution into the center. That's what I'm currently working on. Of course, one can try to increase the burning, to improve the description of burning in late phases when the flame enters the distributed burning regime. This was also recently addressed in a very simple zero-order approach. However, if all those measures don't help, of course, one has to think about implementing other features like a delayed detonation. Another future directions are listed here. So I want to assess the initial models, which I hope to get input here while I'm in Santa Barbara. So I would like to thank you for your
questions.
Steve, do you expect the carbon-oxygen ratio of the white dwarf to depend on the mass of the main sequence progenitor or the metallicity of the main sequence progenitor?
I think so, yes. It is, yes. Oh, but in what way? Well, I think for this you would have to ask Lars.
I don't remember which way. Yes, there's a strong dependence on the initial mass, but to be honest, I totally forgot. It keeps changing.
But at least it is
the output of carbon. The output plus carbon going to oxygen, it keeps changing. So there's a dependence, but it's
around 8, isn't it?
That's the maximum mass that makes carbon oxygen. It's probably 8 or 9 solar mass.
There's a meta paper, they say, will they say in which direction the metallicity affects the carbon ratio.
There's a metallicity dependence, too. Right. So, you would expect that all these objects have the same initial carbon-oxygen ratio. There should be some diversity there alone.
Yeah, in particular, you have to wonder if the, you know, the ones in the direction of the one which had higher mass means
yes. Yes. Did you say that rotation
doesn't matter? No, I didn't say that. Probably it does matter, but it's not included in our models, and the group in Würzburg and Sina's group, there's a student working on this. Well, it's not quite clear whether this is really large, has really large effect, because we discussed it this morning, so in order to have really different masses of the white dwarf, for instance, you would have you need rather large rotation velocities, and even if you have both, it's not clear whether this would affect the flame propagation, because the explosion takes place on timescales of 1.5 seconds, so this is probably much slower than the period of breakup rotation. Which is,
yeah.
Yeah, but
the turbulent structure.
Well, so it may change from which features actually dominate than the turbulent frame structure. So maybe you get some features that are more along the axis. Also, that could be.
I wonder if it could help with your downdraft. I wonder if it could help with mixing the downdrafts to get more complete burning.
Yeah, maybe, but this is well,
you know,
something else. And if you have, well.
Is it understood how the white dwarf avoids nobles as it approaches the chances of carbon?
Well, I'm really not an expert in the progenitor evolution, but.
You can join our reading groups. Yeah, we can see. The answer is no, it's not clear.
Yeah.
This is the story, but how? What's the binary that actually doing it?
Can you your last, thing, like distributed burning? Like, mm-hmm. That's distributed burning when you have, because we talked about this more.
Yeah.
Distributed burning happens in the low density part of the cell, but
right.
Like your downdrafts are high density material.
Yeah, but this has been already expanded to very low densities. It expands and expands, so it's still burned.
Oh, I see.
So you end up with low enough density.
Okay. All right. But so for all your models done, you only want them about 10 seconds. So there is.
Yeah, but we start following the burning at when the fuel reaches the density of 10^7, when it enters distributed burning.
Oh,
because
okay.
It was always assumed that distributed burning the effect of turbulence penetrating the internal structure of the flame would be that the burning is very slow. And that it does not consume very much fuel, but this is not quite clear.
I see. And why is that? Is there an easy way to understand why?
It has a different scaling then. It does not scale directly to the turbulent velocity fluctuations, but then also the laminar burning velocity comes into play again.
Right.
And the laminar burning velocity is very low at low densities.
Okay, so then the general statement really is that the turbulent velocities have reached and turbulent velocities are much lower. Really.
That's also the case, of course. In late stages, the turbulence freezes out. The large scale structure freezes out, so we have less turbulence, of course. Yeah.
I see.
So,
Chris,
is here
another
2 weeks. I encourage everyone to take advantage of this practice. And thank you.